Okay, so we are at the 23rd day of April 2018. It is the Ches, the 8th day of Iyar, Tavshin Ayin Ches. First time saying long Tachlun in a very long time. Right, we didn't say last Monday. What was we would say last Monday? Was Rosh Chodesh? It was Rosh Chodesh, so, yeah, right. So Sunday Monday was Rosh Chodesh. Okay. Anyways, so over the course of this parak that we were learning, it also happens to be in this week's parsha. So we have the prohibition, as mentions, the idea of Masechem Losei Leichud. One is not supposed to follow in the ways of the non-Jews. So besides being in this parak, it also appears three prakim later, at the very end of Parshas Kedoshim. I know we did this last night. Sorry. At the end of Parshas Kedoshim, got to be resourceful, right? At the end of Parshas Kedoshim mentions as well a similar pasuk, and for some reason the Sefer Achin that goes over there, not over here, even though this is the line, this is the line that's invoked in the Gemara for the two primary examples that appear in the Gemara of this prohibition of the Chuseichem Lo Seilechem. So what are those two sugyas? So one of them appears in Masechta Sanhedrin, Daf Nun Beis Amud Beis. I don't have it written down in front of me. I believe that that's what it is. So in Sanhedrin, Daf Nun Beis Amud Beis, the Gemara asks about how do we perform the Isser of, not the Isser, how do we perform the Misa of Saif? How do we execute somebody using a, how do we execute somebody? That's the question. So Saif literally means a sword. So the Gemara wants to know, how do you do that Misa? Srefa is burning. Ila Srefa, Herig, Vechenek. Herig. Herig. Okay, so how do we do Herig? The Gemara wants to know. So the Gemara says, well, you should use a knife. You should use a sort of scythe. So the Gemara says, so the Rabbi Yehuda complains to him and says, you can't use a scythe, but that's a misa menuvelasi. That's going to be, literally means, I don't know, nasty, yucky, disgusting. That's a disgusting way to kill somebody. Rather, what should you use? You should use a cleaver. You want to say, they said to Rabbi Yehuda, that's like worse. I'm not even sure what a cleaver is, but it sounds pretty bad, right? So that's even worse than using a scythe. What are you talking? You said you can't use a scythe because it's menuvelas, because it's disgusting, but now you're going to say to use something worse. To which Rabbi Yehuda responds by saying, yeah, you're right, that's a good question, but what can I do? The non-Jews kill by using a sword, and the Pasuk says, you're not allowed to go in the ways of the non-Jews. So the Gemara then says, oh, that's okay, because we have an example in the Torah itself of a Jewish king. I forget what the exact pasuk is, but it quotes a pasuk to demonstrate that even Jewish kings, even in Tanakh, it's found that they killed using a sword, and therefore the Rabbanan said that it's permissible to use a sword. So what is the impression that one gets from that Gemara? That generally, if doing something that non-Jews do would be a violation of Uvuchu Seifem Lo Se Lehu, unless there's a pasuk, if there's some kind of source that we ourselves have, so then one is not going to be in violation of the pasuk, of that prohibition. But it sounds like you need to have a source. Without a source, you are going to be in violation of that prohibition. So that's sugya number one. Sugya number two appears, and there is krusa. The two sugyas recognize that each other exists and kind of have a little bit of an interplay, but not enough. The Gemara never actually, it doesn't seem to work out what the issue is. The Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah, towards the beginning, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah talks about something called Sorfin al Hamalachim. What does that mean? To burn for the kings. So what do they burn for the kings? So there is a halacha that we have, that we take the king's things, the king's objects, and they burn them. Why do we do this? The Gemara asks, wait a second, but that's Darkei Amori. That's the way of the non-Jews. The non-Jews take all the king's stuff and burn them. They take the king's wives and burn them, right? So that's not what we're talking about. But we take some of the king's stuff and burn them. So the Gemara says, yeah, that's true, but there's a very good reason why we would do so. What's the very good reason that we would do so? Because it shows kavod to the malchus. It shows kavod, shows honor to the king, and therefore it's going to be okay. So you have these two.
What are the circumstances?
The king dies. I forgot to say the king died?
Yeah.
The king died. So therefore, in order to show.
That's a reason to burn the wife?
Not by us. But I'm saying that such things took place. Such things were done.
Take the wife.
What?
So nobody else can have the wife.
So nobody else can, right? To demonstrate that really, you know, it's all about the king and all the wonderful things that one can learn from that idea. So in halacha, we do have this concept of burning things of the king in order to make. In order to make this point. So, but it doesn't seem to mention the pasuk. Now, the truth is that Gemara mentions the idea of there being a pasuk, and the Gemara Sanhedrin also mentions the idea, how can you do that? The Gemara responds by saying, well, there is a pasuk. Yeah, there is a pasuk that talks about Sidkiyahu, I believe, was promised that you, all your stuff, you'll be burned. Not you'll be burned, but your stuff will be burned. I mean, you'll die with the way of the covenant of the Chacham. So we see that there is a source in Tanakh, and therefore it's going to be okay. But it doesn't. They seem to be in the Gemara of Avodah Zarah. They seem to be independent. It first doesn't make sense, and then it also talks about there being a source. So the Rishonim ask, well, okay, which one is it? We have one Gemara that seems to say that you need to have a source for it. You have a source in Tanakh, and the Gemara, which is in Sanhedrin, the Gemara of Avodah Zarah seems to say that such a thing is not necessary. So Tosfos in Maseches Sanhedrin picks up on this and says, yeah. Really, the idea is that there needs to be a pasuk. Yes, it's true, it's making sense, but once even though it makes sense, you need to have a pasuk in order to back it up, which Tosfos seems to be saying that that's the din. It needs to be some kind of source. The Ran and Avodah Zarah disagree. He seems to be saying, I don't believe he disagrees outright. He just says, oh, we see from the Gemara and Maseches Avodah Zarah that you need to have an idea. If it's a good idea why it exists, if it's logical, so then it's okay. If it's not logical, it's not okay. So to which the Minchas Chinuch, logical, it's not okay. Fine. So we seem to have a machlokas rishon. Tosfos seems to say you need to have a pasuk, and the Ran seems to say that it needs to be logical. So there is a famous tshuva where kind of the story of chukas agayim, the prohibition of chukas agayim starts. Where everybody quotes this shita of the, you remember, the Ma'arik. The Ma'arik is early, I think, 1200s or so. Remember what the shaila was about? What was the shaila about?
I was going to ask you who the Ma'arik was.
Rav Yitzchak Kolon, I believe, was his name. He's a somewhat early rishon, like 1200 or so. I believe.
Was the
Maral? Maral's later. Maral's. Yeah, right. He needed to wait for there to be a golem. He was in the. Maral was in the 1700s.
So what does Maral?
Maybe not, maybe a little earlier. Maybe he was a little earlier, but I believe the Maral is quoted in Shulchan Aruch.
I thought it was 1650.
Yeah, right. The earlier, I believe he's quoted in Shulchan Aruch. Okay, maybe it's Ma'arik is earlier. The Ma'arik had a shayla about, can you wear doctor's coats? Is it permitted to wear doctor's coats? Because that seems to be, because the Gaim, right? They developed it for themselves. So he says that it's okay. Why is it okay? And this is sort of the principle that Ma'arik establishes. Ma'arik, and is also the quote of Shulchan Aruch. He believes it's okay because he believes that there's a logical reason why one would want to wear doctor's coats. Because people want to know who the doctor is, right? Gives you street cred, and I had a member of my shul in Phoenix who now is like the chief of surgery in one of the hospitals there. But he told me that when he was a resident, so he goes in and he gave a pelvic exam to a woman, and he finishes and he's taking off his gloves, says, "Okay, I'm going to get the doctor now." This woman says, "Who the heck are you?" And I remember also there was a commercial I remember seeing for a company that made uniforms. I forget the name of the company. But he said, the tagline was, without a uniform, he's just some guy playing around under your sink. So we understand why there would be good reason why it would be good to have for people to have uniforms. So then that would be okay. So Ma'arik actually, so that's the way it's often described. Ma'arik gives a couple of limitations on it that are quoted in Shulchan Aruch. He says that, yeah, provided that there's no basis in Pritzos and there's no basis in Avodah Zarah. That if there is a relationship to Avodah Zarah, it's going to be problematic. If there's a relationship to Pritzos, it's going to be a problem. Pritzos is like immorality. There's a connection to immorality, which actually is the connection within our parak. It's a connection to immorality. So then it's going to be problematic. So in fact, I saw today in the Sefer Masoras Moshe. So Masoras Moshe came out, it was published mostly by, collected by Mordechai Tendler. Mordechai Tendler was the grandson of Rav Moshe Feinstein, Moshe David Tendler's son. He really, from what I understand, lived with his grandfather for a pretty long time and was there. You know, he's the one who picked up the phone when people called. He was the one who drove his father where he needed to be driven places. He was pretty very close with his grandfather, Rav Moshe. So So he mentions, he was saying he wants having a discussion about this, because so he came up with an addition to Masoras Moshe, which a lot of interesting things, meaning we're kind of stuck sometimes with what Rav Moshe wrote in Tshuvos, but there was a lot of things that Rav Moshe said that never necessarily got published. There was a big machlokas about this recently, if anybody has followed the big beer machlokas. Anybody catch this? Did we talk about it in Shul? I mentioned it in Shul. If one followed, there's a blog called Headlines. That's where I got my information from on this. Headline, this is blog. It's an audio. You should go and, not a blog, a podcast called Headlines, put together by some of Rabbi, I'm not sure you even have Smicha, David Lichtenstein, who has this radio/podcast that he does weekly. All his good stuff. He brings on interesting guests and things like that. So a couple of weeks ago, right after Pesach, he discussed the big beer controversy in New York, because it was discovered that the major beer distributor for all of New York, for I think everything except Budweiser, was Jewish. That presents the problem right after Pesach, right? It's Chametz Shavuot Lev HaPesach, and was owned by a Jew during that time. So part of it is that this was recognized before Pesach, and they tried to get him to sell, and they actually did. They did perform a mechira with him, but it's a little bit of a question. I'm not sure it's even a questionable mechira is the best way to put it. But there are those that don't want to rely on such a sale, because practically he stayed open over Yontif. So he stayed over Yontif, but he sold the province. So there's ways of technically of doing this, but the OU and the Star K both said that one told their caterers not to rely on that sale. So why is that the case? So apparently the OU has a Masorah from Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik was the halachic authority for the Orthodox Union, and when he was alive, and he said that he doesn't believe in these types of sales. He thinks, you know, they shouldn't be done, they shouldn't be relied on. Anytime you make a sale and the person remains open, that's problematic. Personally, I think, because I did a little bit of research into this for a couple of shilohs that I got over the years, I think my perception, it's hard for me to say this without really seeing it in print. I believe Rav Soloveitchik had a major sociological objection, because during that time, when Rav Soloveitchik was saying these things, it was the 40s and 50s and 60s, that's when all these Jews had to stay open. There was a lot of pressure of staying open on Shabbos. And I think he felt that if we give that heter, then everybody's just going to sign it and stay open on Yontif, and stay open on Shabbos and Yontif. So he was hesitant to give that, and he said they shouldn't be relied on. Let's put it this way. His Talmidim have said that one has the right to write such a theorem these days. But whatever the case, the OU said we have a Masorah from the Rav, that we don't rely on that. So they also interviewed over the Shavuot, he interviewed Rabbi Tendler, I forget his first name, who is one of the senior halachic authorities at the Star K. So he's Rav Moshe Feinstein's great grandson. I think he's Rav Moshe David Tendler's grandson. I'm not sure he's much a kid. I'm not sure whose kid he is. But I met him a couple years ago when I took a course at the Star K. A very interesting guy. Not a young guy. Probably only a couple years older than me. I'm not sure I can still qualify for a young guy, but as much as I consider a young guy, he's I think only a few years older than me, but he has a pretty important position already at the Star K. So he was interviewed for this, and he said Rav Heinemann also is strict upon this, and so the person doing the talk, Rabbi David Lichtenstein, says, but Rav Moshe has several tshuvos where he says to rely on it. So why would Rav Heinemann want to be machmir against Rav Moshe, who Rav Moshe seems to say that one can rely on such sales that take place? So Rav Tendler responded by saying, it's true that he has those tshuvos, but we have a Masorah in the family that really only wanted to do that bidia, but that he didn't really want to do l'chadchila, it was only a after the fact kind of heter, etc. So that's always an uncomfortable place to be, right? When somebody writes something explicitly and then there's a tradition outside of the book, I mean, it's a tradition in the family, a tradition here, a tradition there. So what do you do with that? Do we accept it, not accept it? How does one take that into account?
It's not after the fact.
No, that l'chadchila b'diavad means coming two things. B'diavad sometimes means after the fact. I mean, once it's done, and what do we judge it now? B'diavad, we also have a concept in halacha called shasar chak b'diavad dami. The shasar chak, that when something is in a difficult situation, it's treated like a b'diavad. So it's in difficult, right? The eruv is down on Shabbos, so we might rely on leniencies to do something one way or another. Yes, it's true, you haven't done it yet, but it's still considered that that case. So anyways, in general in halacha, it's always it's a challenge to judge what's in print versus what the people have heard. Remember, Sobolevsky would often, whenever he would quote from the Chazon Ish, or something not explicitly written in the Chazon Ish, he would always qualify it by saying that the Chazon Ish used to tell people that anything that's not written, that you shouldn't trust anything that's not written explicitly in the Sefer Chazon Ish. You shouldn't trust anything said in my name that's not explicitly written in the Sefer Chazon Ish. Right? The problem is that he didn't write that in the Chazon Ish. He only said it to people, right? So what do you deal with that? But anyway, so that's what the Sefer is Masoras Moshe. So there was a volume 1 that came out a couple of years ago. Very interesting. And then I was in a farm store a couple weeks ago in Teaneck, and so they came with a volume 2. But it wasn't like in the new printing area. It was like, it was on the shelf someplace. I asked the person, when did this come out? A few years ago. So I guess I'm out of it. Philadelphia, you don't catch all the news farm that come out. But anyways, so I just opened up to the section of Hilchos Kukas Hagdayim today, and he says that I once talked to my father with regards to the doctors, that they asked me, what about wearing glimos? And what's helpful here, he takes some of the hard words and translates them into English. Gowns. What about the gowns? Shalovshin b'siyim halimudim b'tekes kabbalas hatuudos. About the that they wear at the conclusion of at the ceremony when they receive their diplomas. I mean, what about graduation gowns? So he suggests hu nichlal b'isuchu kasagayim v'havi kaviz rayuda avodazara. Yeah, that should be a problem because it's like avodazara and it's connected to avodazara. Aloha collegeim harishonim hayushel hagalachim, because the first colleges were for priests. V'heim kach lavshu, and that's what they wore. V'shar ha'universiyos halachu anagazumehem, and the rest of the universities took this idea of wearing gowns from them. V'hiskim rabbeinu v'amar b'vadei shasu. Yes, definitely aser. V'osafti, and I added on shigami lithun shezed davar shigami yehudim hayu mechashvim. They don't think that this is something that also Jews would have done. Shalom niyas v'shekadai lavshos kolimos shehu malvish mishuna im shachmiya. I mean, this is such an odd thing. Why would you wear? It's not like a regular clothing you wear. It's an odd clothing you wear. So obviously, and Rav Moshe agreed. And then he added this eight words here. V'tama Rabbeinu, and Rav Moshe wondered, lama gam bi yeshiva university kach noagin. So why do they do this in yeshiva university? So I could speak from experience after going to yeshiva university that it's always like a big issue leading up to graduation, right? Who, you know, that the guys are like kind of uncomfortable wearing these gowns because of this. There is positions that it would be that would be problematic. Our position's not. In fact, he continues on and points out that it could be that it's not really based on Avodah Zarah. It's just the reality is that in Europe the only people that were educated were Avodah Zarah people, right? But maybe it does qualify as some type of special garment, etc. Like he kind of points out that Svara, but doesn't accept it. Rav Moshe doesn't accept it. Rav Moshe probably held that it was prohibited.
So is that the opinion that Christianity is Avodah Zarah?
Well, everybody agrees Christianity is Avodah Zarah for us. Right, for a Jew to do Christianity would be Avodah Zarah. The problem is, when they're doing it, are they in violation of Avodah Zarah? But from our perspective, we'd be following a way of Avodah Zarah. Yes, we would assume that would be problematic, especially because the Rambam seems to assume that it's not really based on Avodah Zarah, it's really following non-Jews. Anyways, so the Marik, one of his qualifications is that it can't be following of... can't be following a what's it called an Avodah Zarah consideration. The other limitation the Ma'arik puts on is that it can't have to do with snus, it can't have to do with immorality. So if there is a style that is connected somehow to immorality, so that would be problematic. So when we learned Chukas Hagayim in the shul a couple of a year ago already, so I had the ha'ara that there are styles that would be considered snias that are that halachically would fit within the styles for women that halachically would fit within the parameters of sneas, but perhaps might be problematic. So one of them, I thought that maybe the types of dresses where there's like a window, you know, like it's a long dress, it goes way below the knees, but then there's like a part that you see through, right? Like a dress goes, then there's a see through, and then the dress continues again, right? So that could be put in somewhat connected to stylish looks for them. I thought that might be considered to be a problem. I never asked anybody about it, but I thought that might be a problem of Chukas Hagayim. Okay. So, anyways, so that's the shita of the Ma'arik. The problem with the shita, and that's actually what's quoted in the Rama. The Rama quotes us the halacha that. Aval davar shenagu l'toelas. If it's something that has a purpose, gun shadarchan shakol misha who rofid. Anybody who's a doctor, mumcha yesh lo malbush miyuchad, should have a specific garment that they wear. Shenikar bo shu rofid. That's clear that he's a doctor. Uman mutar l'lov show. It's permitted for him to wear it. V'chein sheosin mishum kavod o tam acher mutar. And also, if they wear it for kavod, that would also be permissible. That's what the Maharik says. And therefore, he also lachin amru shorfen al malachim ve'imu mishum darke emori. And that's why it's permissible to do the burning for the kings. And it's not considered dark yamori because it's a way of considering giving kavod. Okay? Good so far? Question is asked, however, on the page from the Vilna Gaon, as well as in the Minchas Chinuch, it says, but you forgot about a whole Gemara. Right? What do you do with the Gemara in Sanhedrin that seems to say that it needs to be based on a pasuk? Right? That's what the Gemara, that's the other side of the Gemara. So how do you deal with that? And the Vilna Gaon says, and therefore I think the Rama's wrong, I think the Maharik's wrong, and I think you have to be machmir on this question, whatever that chumra means. But anything that one does, one has to be machmir. So what would that imply? So it would imply with regards to clothing that Jews have to wear. This is an example, this is what the Gemara is actually talking about, that Jews need to wear a distinct mode of dress. Right? They need to wear a distinct mode of dress. That's the end of, and that's the end of the story. even within the Maharik, whenever Rosh Hashanah would talk about this in Shir, when I was in Shir, it came up a few times, and he sometimes would point to his tie and say, yeah, so a tie would actually be a problem according to the Maharik, because there's no purpose to it. Yeah. And then, like, okay. But outside of the Maharik, right, so, I mean, you can make a case, it makes sense to wear short jackets instead of long jackets. Because long jackets are hard to walk in and they're much too hot, and it makes sense to wear short jackets. Even though it's like the guy, but it makes sense that it's like the guy. But how does one deal with the Maharik? But how does one deal with the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin? So I came across a couple, two different things to say on this topic. So number one is a suggestion by the session that the Minchas Asher has. Rav Asher Weiss quotes. Actually, he says himself, he goes to based on a medrash, that he feels that anything that is done, even if it's made by non-Jews. So I remember somebody once brought up, well, what about wearing jeans? What about wearing dungarees? Would that be a problem? So said, what do you mean? Who invented dungarees?
Levi
Strauss. Right? So it's invented by a Jew, so it's not a problem. Really? That's what makes the difference? If it was made by a Jew versus made by a non-Jew? That's the whole deal? So in the Minchas Asher, he suggests that anything that is invented for people is not in the realm of Chukas Hagoyim. Right? If it's invented for... If it was invented sort of as a vodas, as a hanhaga, if it was sort of created as something that non-Jews do, so then it's a problem for Jews to start doing it as well. But if it was invented as, this is what people should do in general, so then it's not even within the realm of Chukas Hagoyim. So that's very helpful. Meaning even people who are very strict about wearing Jewish garments, like Hasidim who dress up in distinctly Jewish dress, they're still going to wear boots, right? They're still going to wear gloves. They're still going to wear coats and hats, right? So why is that okay? And the answer is because those are inventions that are for mankind. They're not really part of the Hanhaga. This is something that we do either out of convenience or because it's helpful. So that he bases that on a medrash, and that's answer number one. Another idea that I found today in the back of the Masifta Gemara here, so he quotes from the Sefer Imri Esh. So Imri Esh raises this question. He says, how could it be? So he suggests that even the Rambam Maharik, that they say, Sheitiru lino kemina kagayim edvarim sheish behem tam ve'im behem pritzis vodazara, adayin yish lachlok velomar, shelo hitiru ela bedvarim shekesha'asa osam ha'yisrael, lo niru mimasav ke'iluhu miyakir es min hagei hagayim bedaitam. That anything that a Jew, that is permissible, so long as whatever the Jew does, it's not doing it like the non-Jews do it. If he's doing it like the non-Jews do it, so then that's problematic. And that's what and that's how he would understand those Gemaras. I mean, the Gemara that talks about the sword, the Gemara that talks about the thing, those could be distinctly non-Jewish actions. That's the way they did it in the non-Jewish court. That's the way they did it, the non-Jewish king did it. Right, so then you have a shaila of chukas hagayim. But if it's not clear by your actions that you're doing something like the non-Jews do it, so then it would be okay. I had a Rebbe in ninth grade that was very upset about... what was it? That was when the Knicks were very good. And the Knicks had this... Whenever the Knicks did something good, they chest bumped. Right? So I had a Rebbe in ninth grade that he said, I watched one of your basketball games, and I see his chest bumping. What is that? That's Lucas Agai. He says, I understand a high five. A high five is good. Why do a high five? Because really, the Kavadik way to do after a guy hits a nice shot is to give him a Yasher Koach, to shake his hand. But the game's still going on. So he can't shake his hand. So, fine, you give him a high five or a fist bump. You understand that. But to go and do a chest bump, so that's Lucas Agai. That's acting in the way of the non-Jews. So anything that would be distinctly like them, that would be problematic. That is the suggestion that the Imri Eish gives. Fine. One more thing I'd like to point out. Assuming you're still, everyone's still with me? Okay, so one more thing to point out, and that is, in the very next sif in Shulchan Aruch, he says as follows: Mishu karov l'malchus. If somebody is karov l'malchus, what would that mean, karov l'malchus? Malchus.
Malchus.
Malchus, Melech, the king. Karo means someone who's close to the king. Someone who's close to the king, and he needs to wear certain clothing like them. So that would be mutter. That would be permissible.
One of our classes.
One of the classes we had that, okay. So that's an interesting thing. Why would that be permissible? Especially if we assume, Ubechukusechen lo seilech. It was an Issur d'oraisa. Right, it's an Issur d'oraisa. It's a biblical prohibition. So hold on. So when are you allowed to violate? When are you allowed to violate Issur d'oraisa? To save life, right? So is this really considered saving life? So maybe it is, but down the road. We have an assumption in halacha. I mean, can a person go to medical school on Shabbos and include all the violations of the medical ones? One day I'm going to save a life, right? So we assume not. The Nod Rabbi Yehuda, my alter Zaidi, has probably the most famous tshuva on this topic, where he discusses doing autopsies. So is it permissible to do autopsies on a dead Jewish person? And he says, well, it depends. If there's what he calls a chol lefaninu, if there's a sick person right there that a guy just died from some kind of virus, and we're going to be able to take the antidote, if we open it up, we'll be able to use that knowledge to save someone else who's sick right now. Because that would be okay. But to do it for research, where maybe someone down the road is going to be saved by this, so he felt that would be prohibited. You're required to have a chola bifaninu, or in this case one which suggests a sakana bifaninu. So how do we permit violating an issur d'oraisa just because the person is karov l'malchus, and one day there's going to perhaps be some kind of situation. So the Kesef Mishnah, Yosef Karo raises this question in his commentary on the Rambam, and he gives two answers. Right? Answer number one is that he says, well, if you're Karov L'malchus, it's always a Sakanas Nefashos. That's the definition of being Karov L'malchus. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. It's talking about a case of Sakanas Nefashos. That's what he says. I think that's all that he himself says. Let me just see it inside. Where do you see it? There it is. So the Siv Gimel Karav L'Malchus, he quotes, this idea is quoted from a Gemara Maseches Baba Kama in Perek Meruba, where it talks about Avtulus Bar Ruvain, that it was permissible for him to get a specific type of haircut, even though it would qualify as Lucas Agayim, because he was what we call Karav L'Malchus. He was close to the king. That's what the Gemara answers. So the Gemara says, V'im Tavar Kibish Chazar Rabbein Shaluk Alkal, V'yish Lom Rishim Hatzalos Yisrael Hu, the Shara, that it was permissible in order to save Jews. That when Jews are in front of the king, they would save Jews. That was the reason. And the second reason, he says, is because all the details of Huseim Loseilechu are not clear. We don't know what they are. So it's a concept called Masra L'Chachamim. That the idea was Masra Davar L'Chachamim. The idea was given over to the Chachamim, to the Tzarabanim, to figure out what it's going to be. And they decided to exclude Karov L'Malchus. They excluded that from the prohibition. Rav Chanan, I guess we don't have time to get into it, takes a little bit of issue with that. He's got to work out how that exactly works, because if they're just defining what that is, they can't include exceptions to it. That's not really what it means. But Rav Chanan at least gives a pshat as to how to explain that. And that's how we understand the second answer. And the second answer is actually what's quoted in the Meforshim on Shulchan Aruch. But how does one understand the first answer? So Rabbi Luchnasi on one of these podcasts pointed out. He says what he was talking about. about Kushner and Ivanka, right? This whole thing a couple months ago that they went on a plane on Shabbos, how was that okay? A couple of things revolving the inauguration, why was that okay? So the assumption was that he's Karov L'Malchus. If he's Karov L'Malchus, right, and so then that's one of the grounds for Heter. Whose life is he saving right now? The answer is that when you are a Karov L'Malchus, it's always Sakanas L'Fashus. You are living in that reality. And that is that's the explanation. If one wants to see a little bit more on that, there's a whole give and take that's available online between Rabbi Broid and Rabbi Alman that goes back already 10 years at this point to Obama's inauguration. When Obama was inaugurated, there was a whole brouhaha that they had. Every year they have a prayer breakfast or prayer thing the next day. And Obama wanted each denomination of Jews to be presented at this and to offer a prayer. So he first went to Rabbi Weinreb at the OU. Rabbi Weinreb said, no, I'm not comfortable doing this. And instead he went to Rabbi Luchstein. So Rabbi Luchstein from KJ went and gave this talk in the church in Washington. The National Cathedral went in and gave this talk. So this led to a major controversy whether that was appropriate or not. One of them hinged on this question. Is Rabbi Luchstein, who's the president, who's the rabbi of a shul on the east side, is he considered Karov L'Malchus? He claimed, yes, because I went and I spoke to Obama and I spoke truth to power and I said to him, you know, when you were in Sderot, you said, I wouldn't allow bombs to fall to my backyard and Israel's the right to defend itself, so remember that now that you're president. While others claim that's not Karov L'Malchus, that's giving a statement to the president. Karov L'Malchus is somebody who's involved with this every day on a regular basis. That's who qualifies for the permissibility of Karov L'Malchus. Anyways, that question is still out there. Karov L'Malchus might mean different things in different circumstances. It also might mean that not necessarily you're Karov L'Malchus, but your organization is Karov L'Malchus. There's many details to try to figure out how to work that out, but at least that heter is out there to be used for those that need it for those that don't. Okay, stop here.